Hello, you're listening to Queer Everything, a queer of color podcast about thriving in the world while being at odds with it. I'm Lena Rafiq Sheikh.
My guest today is Mix Yaffa, the executive director of the Muslim Alliance for Sexual and Gender Diversity, or Masjid. Yaffa is a queer Palestinian poet, author, activist, and death doula whose family history of multiple displacements goes back 3 to 4 generations. In this episode, Yaffa shares their and their family's history of displacement and movement. I feel privileged by her willingness to share her story as a visible, trans, Palestinian Muslim person, especially in this moment. I'm also inspired by her deep commitment to supporting people through unimaginably hard experiences, which she talks more about in the next episode, where we'll hear more about what she and Masjid are doing to support the queer, Muslim, and Palestinian community in this period of danger, violence, and escalating Islamophobia. Welcome. Hello, everybody. I'm really excited to welcome Mix Yaffa, who is the executive director of Masjid, which is the Muslim Alliance for Sexual and Gender Diversity. Yaffa is a poet, an activist, and a death doula. Yaffa, hi, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So for people who aren't familiar with who you are yet, would you introduce yourself to us briefly?
Absolutely. So I'm a queer and trans indigenous displaced Palestinian. My family has dealt with 3-4 generations of displacement at this point from multiple wars from Palestine, from the Gulf War. And then I was actually living in southern Syria as the Syrian revolution started. So I've also been there during that active war zone. I have a multitude of different backgrounds. I have a background in engineering, as a death doula, a birthing doula, a yoga teacher, a novelist, various things. I've kind of grown up all over the place due to that displacement. So I've lived in 9 countries. I've lived in close to a dozen states over my just 31 years of life. And now I'm the executive director of the Muslim Alliance for Sexual and Gender Diversity, which is an organization that supports queer and trans Muslims wherever they are, just building different spaces. And we're actually looking at building some additional crisis support systems moving forward.
Given what's happening right now?
Yeah. To be honest, our community has been having this conversation for the last 6 or so months in anticipation to the elections next year. Wow. We thought it would be getting really, really bad next year, but it's definitely gotten really bad this year as well. I mean, like it has for every year for queer and trans Muslims and just queer and trans people in general. And so, yeah, we're hoping to have all of that prior to even more escalation that we're foreseeing will happen even after all of this is over.
So in that very short introduction, there's like 10 things I want to ask you about already. So let's work backwards. How long have you been the executive director at Masjid, and how did the creation of Masjid come about?
So I've just been the executive director of Masjid for a little over a year. But Masjid has been around since 2011, and it was actually started by a group of queer Muslims who had come together in Georgia, and they really just wanted to build a space that was going to be a gathering space for queer and trans Muslims and their partners, which is where the Masjid retreat initially was started from. And a lot of the individuals who founded Masjid were also a lot of the same individuals who founded things like Al-Fatiha and were part of some of the older queer Muslim organizing spaces. And so Masjid just kind of became part of that legacy. For the first few years of Masjid's existence, it was really just about hosting a yearly retreat where queer and trans Muslims and their partners can come together. And the last year they held it, it had over 150 people there, which just sounds so magical to me. I've never been. I learned about Masjid right after the last one, and I've been waiting for it since then. But then right before it was coming back, COVID happened. So everything kind of moved virtually. And then, yeah, all of those different individuals did such an incredible job at really building the foundation of what Masjid stands for. And so when I came in as the first executive director, I was able to really support the expansion and the elevation of that and just supporting the sustainment of the organization. So now we have consistent monthly programming that are available to everyone within our community. We do more intensive skill building spaces. So we've done like transformative justice skill building spaces. We went back to our retreat a couple of months ago and due to COVID, we ended up deciding that it would be a smaller retreat. So it had about 15 mm-hmm. people. And SubhanAllah just organically was an all-Black participant at mm-hmm. Queer and Trans Muslim Retreat, which was really beautiful because mm-hmm. I know our Black community members are also dealing with additional layer of intersect, right, and marginalization. And so being able to offer that space was really beautiful. And like I said, now we're looking to have some additional programming where some case management and crisis support systems can be built out for our community.
That's really important work. Did I hear you correctly that you were doing this in anticipation of the Islamophobia that you anticipated would be ramping up in the wake of the 2024 elections?
Exactly. Yeah, we were really expecting the Islamophobia to really be ramped up and then the queer and transphobia to be ramped up around May. And also, unfortunately, with this past year, with the Al-Yaqeen Institute statement. Right. And unfortunately, I think within most like right-wing groups, and this was a really large way that the more conservative Muslim community kind of came after us. But even prior to that, every May, we see an uptick in things in time for Pride. And so we were also expecting that. So having Islamophobia from the larger side, and then having the right wing coming after us for the queer and transphobia, but then also having the smaller, more conservative Muslim community that had allied themselves with the more evangelical right wings to kind of come after us as well. I don't know how much of that is going to shift now, though, right? I feel like a lot of that goodwill that was being built between the more conservative right wing and the Muslim conservative groups, a lot of it, I would hope, has completely been disintegrated. And so it will be, May feels like a lifetime from now at this point. We don't even know what's going to happen in like the next week or two weeks.
Yeah.
Literally the next day, right? And so we expect it to get worse then. Unless things drastically change now, which is always a beautiful way of everything's possible.
Everything's possible. Yeah. I've been thinking about that letter and that tenuous alliance that was built and been thinking like the last few days, like, I wonder how that's going for you all now.
Yeah. Right?
So you talked a moment ago about your family's history of displacement over 3 to 4 generations. You live in the States now. Tell me, as much as you're open to sharing, like, what is your family's history with that?
So my dad's side of the family is originally from Yaffa. And then my mom's side of the family are from Jenin. So Jenin is in the West Bank. Yaffa is not. And so as everything was ramping up before 1948, Yaffa was one of the largest targets for Zionists. And I always remember a conversation that I had with my grandmother years and years and years ago, before I even really understood a lot of this, where we were talking about her schooling, and she was like, yeah, I really wanted to stay in school. And I was like, oh, like, why didn't you? I think I must have been like 6 at the time. And she was like, oh, well, when I was your age, I had to stop because otherwise the Zionists would shoot us. And she was like, they would just wait for us outside of our schools. And that's how that was one of the pathways that they were really scaring Palestinians, right? And so people stopped going to school. And same with my grandfather, who's just 2 years older than her. And from a pretty young age, they both ended up moving to Nablus, so into what is now considered the West Bank. And that was where they grew up and, you know, came into adulthood, met, got married, and started their family. And at the time, even before 1967, they were really trying to make it as impossible as possible, to make it impossible for Palestinians to have any kind of livelihoods, any kind of education, any kind of medical care, like anything at all. And so at the time, my grandfather ended up going back and forth between Kuwait and Nablus because there was work out there. Or at times he would go into Jordan to get money, come back, and so on and so forth, until 1967 happened. And what is now Israel made it illegal for Palestinians to have an education at all. And this was after I didn't know this until about a year ago. My grandmother now is 88. And for the first time ever in a conversation with her last year, she was like, oh, my brother like got into an accident. And I was like, wait, you have brothers? And she's like, oh, I had six brothers. And I was like, oh, where are they? Because that one is still in the West Bank. And she was like, oh, no, all of them were killed.
Wow.
All of them died between 1948 and 1967. And at that point, her parents had died as well from other things. They weren't killed. And so I think it was really difficult for them to stay for all of those reasons. And so ended up moving to Kuwait. And my mom's family had very similar story to the point of, I actually don't know how many uncles my mom had and how many aunts she had, because except for one aunt, all of them were killed in that process. And so both sides of the family ended up moving to Kuwait. So my parents grew up in Kuwait. They met there. They got married there. They had my older two sisters there. And actually, before they had the second oldest, the Gulf War started. And so here they were again, 25 years later, again in another war. And so they lived through that, right? There was, for Palestinians at the time, it was, would have been really difficult for them to go anywhere. So most of the Palestinians stayed until after the war, when Kuwait expelled all of the Palestinians, or like the vast majority of them. I think they expelled about 2 million Palestinians.
And
and that's when different family members went to different European countries. Some went into like North Africa or even East and Central Africa. I have a couple of cousins who moved to South Africa. Some went to the States, and my parents ended up moving to Jordan for the first time in their lives. And so I tell people that I was born, or I was carried between countries before I was born. I was displaced just physically, even before I was born. And so I was born in Jordan, and we stayed a few years in Jordan until we moved to Arizona. My dad wanted to get his PhD. Because of how criminalized education was and how like violent the repercussions were to education, my entire families on both sides have always, like, education is kind of like this holy thing that's like you don't not do it. It's like you could live on the streets, that's fine, but go get a master's. And so everyone in the family, like my dad is one of 11, my mom is one of 9. The very least like anyone has is like a master's almost. Nowadays, there are some with just a bachelor's degree, which is weird. And so even within like my own family, I have 7 biological sisters and then the trans person in the family. And so even between all of us, we all have, most of us have master's. We either have engineering degrees or medical degrees, basically. And it's not because my parents were like, oh, you have to do this, right? Like, because this is like the for other people or an ego thing, like you would expect with a lot of families, but more of just like, no, we get educated to free our people. No one really cares whether that's like a degree or some kind of education pathway where you're just learning and grasping things. And so that's always been there. And so we were in Arizona when 9/11 happened. And so dealt with the repercussions of that. Although I always tell people of our mosque in Arizona was vandalized 2 weeks before 9/11, and it was vandalized 2 weeks after 9/11. But it definitely got a lot worse. Like, I remember when my oldest sister was starting high school, and she was no longer in the Islamic school, her English teacher literally had a picture of Osama bin Laden, and throughout class, they would just throw darts at it. And that gave you bonus, like extra credit. And that was normal at the time, right? That was seen as like perfectly okay. And earlier we were talking about how like this feels a lot like what happened after 9/11. And then we moved to Canada as refugees. And then Canada was, I have a lot of feelings about Canada, but Arizona was bad. But at the very least, we had some community in Arizona. Canada was just bad. Which a lot of people think of Canada as like this place that you go to like for safety from the US. And honestly, it was the opposite experience. And so we ended up as like children, almost forcing our parents to take us to Jordan And we were like, we want to leave, which they thought that we would never want to leave. But we were like, no, like we're just leaving. Y'all can stay. But this, like, it was so bad there in a multitude of ways. And so then I did high school in Jordan. But then I left home when I was 17. So before I graduated high school, which is when I moved to North Jordan, South Syria, and was just kind of part of just being out there. And for the most part, I was just on the streets for about a year and a half as the Syrian revolution was starting, as I was trying to figure things out. And oftentimes people assume that it's because of the queerness and transness. And I've been out for a really long time, but it was just, my family did not necessarily know how to interact with the various mental health challenges that I was experiencing at the time, of how different things were sitting in my body. And so they were actually great. It was just, I needed to be in a place where I could like breathe and really try to figure things out. And following that, I ended up moving back to the US, to Massachusetts on a student visa. And then it doesn't even stop there, right? Then I lived in Switzerland and then back to the US. And then I lived in Hong Kong and then back to the US, lived in Malaysia. And then I was living in New England the last several years until COVID started. Then I moved to Northern Ireland for a couple of years. And then now I'm on occupied Ohlone land out in Oakland, California. And so it's, I feel like to me, that's really the legacy of that displacement. And people ask, oh, like, well, where are your sisters? And I'm like, which ones? Like, you need to clarify, right? Like, there's the one in Turkey. There's the one in China, right? There's the ones that are out here. There are the ones in Jordan. Between all of us, we're a family of 10. Between the 10 of us, we are born in 5 different countries. And yeah, so it's like very much rooted in that displaced experience. And also really conscious of how, even as a displaced person over here, especially where I am in occupied Ohlone land, which is incredibly gentrified, where Indigenous folks are not being honored in a multitude of ways. And so I'm always also thinking of like my role within the space as like my displaced Indigenous, but settler here at the same time.
Right. Right. Well, that's a very complicated history of displacement and movement. And I hear you about the education and the importance of that. So your family is still quite spread out at the moment, huh?
We are, yeah. And a lot of my extended family have settled in Jordan now. And my family were one of the lucky ones where we ended up with Jordanian citizenship because like Palestine, Jordan have always been the same, right? Like, so, so especially on my dad's side, some of his great aunts have been in Jordan for decades prior, even before all of this was starting. We've always had family that just kind of went back and forth. But Jordan is not really home in a lot of ways. Relations in Jordan have definitely gotten a lot better between Jordanians and Palestinians who live there. It's definitely closer to home than anywhere else. Right. And also, it's still not that. And I think it took me a really long time to also recognize that because like my parents would always talk about going back home. Like, and I think they were always referring to Palestine, but every once in a while they would talk about Jordan because like some of their siblings had gone there. And after moving there in high school, realizing of like, wait, my parents have lived only a few months more than I have in Jordan.
Right.
Like, and so they were moving to a brand new place again and again and again. And and so we're a family that hasn't really been able to assimilate into any of the societies that we've lived in. Which I think is probably the easiest way to like explain it. And so we're all over now. And unfortunately, personally, I've never felt at home in any of the places that I've lived in. I've learned to make myself my home, right? So like my house is my home, wherever that is. I can build community, I can build things, but the concept of home, like people don't realize that when you ask, where are you from to a displaced person, that that's not an easy question. That's not a one word answer. That's literally like 40 minutes.
Yeah, I hear that. I very much hear that. My family and I do not have a history of displacement. And a lot of people I talk to on this podcast are part of various diasporas and have also moved around a lot. And I very much resonate what you say, certainly with the my house is my home. So I'd be very curious if you're willing to talk about your journey around your queerness and like how that's been. I mean, I grew up in the Middle East, right? I grew up in the Khalid in Saudi Arabia and Bahrain. And, you know, I know that there's a lot of complexity there that is extraordinarily difficult to communicate to anyone who hasn't lived there. And then there's all sorts of really shitty things, quite frankly, that people project onto that experience. So yeah. Curious what you're willing to share about that.
Yeah, I don't know how unique my experience is. And also I find that it is a little abnormal than a lot of other people's, in the sense of, because of the displacement that I was interacting with, because of the violence that we experienced everywhere that we've lived. I was aware of Palestine and different things around the world, like even before leaving Jordan, and I was six when we left Jordan. And so even before I could really talk, because I'm also autistic, and so it took me a really long time to talk, I understood things. Like I understood how the world operated. But I think because of that, as I was getting into high school, the weight of all of that was so much, and I didn't know how to process any of it, that there was almost no real space to process a lot of these other things in terms of queerness and transness. I will say of like, I've always known I'm trans. And so as a child, I used to think it was more like the autism of like, I just could not understand the concept of gender. And so people would be like, yeah, Feg, you're different than your sisters. And I'd be like, I don't understand. Like, what does that mean? Up until basically as a teenager, when I just gave up, right? I was just like, okay, whatever. Y'all say this. Okay, I will go here. It doesn't matter. So I've always known that. I just never really had language for it. But in terms of the queerness piece, I think there was just so many other things going on that it really wasn't the weight that I was carrying the most at the time, which feels really strange to almost be like privileged with a lot to carry and also like, but it's just the reality of oppression, right? Of just we're carrying so many different things that sometimes it just, we don't have capacity for all these other things that are really important.
Yes.
Yeah. So throughout my childhood and into teenage years and things like that, it wasn't necessarily on my mind so much as like healing from different forms of trauma were more on my mind, but not really knowing what to do with any of that. And even when I got to college, where you would think we were having more conversations, we actually were really not. I went to a small engineering school in Massachusetts called Worcester Polytechnic Institute. And it Worcester. Was, you know, Worcester. Oh, Worcester.
No, Worcester.
Oh, Worcester. That can be an entire conversation on its own. But my college campus was incredibly like apolitical. It was, they did not see color. They did not see anything. It was just, there was nothing. It was devoid of all substance because it was just like, no, you just work as an engineer. And I remember freshman and sophomore year, things starting to stabilize enough that my brain was like, okay, now you're ready for PTSD, right? Now you're ready for all of this. And feeling that sense, I will also like just thinking of displacement and wars. My sophomore year of college was also when there was the immense escalation in the Syrian revolution in Syria. And so knowing people who were dying and kind of similar to what's happening now where, you know, having family on the ground, having friends and watching everyone not really care. And I remember one time I even told a professor, I was like, hey, like, I just need like an extra couple of days for an extension. And he was just like, oh, well, you would need like to go through like the disability office and things. Wow. And I was like, I really don't.
And like, you could do this.
Like you literally can do this. And so anyway, somehow was able to pass. But at the time I was incredibly, incredibly active on campus because I was an international student. And so I knew I had to have everything on my resume for graduation. And also my family was not happy with me being in the US again because of their experiences. And so I was putting myself through college. And so I had four jobs at the same time. And everything was falling apart. And I remember there was this almost like wake up call of if I, who I'm literally on every brochure on campus, I'm seen as like the image of success on campus. I'm literally about to die here. Like how is everyone else doing? And that was when I started like doing more of mental health programming. Mm-hmm. And within that, it was really interesting because I would just talk about everything. So I would talk about things like gender and orientation and religion. Mm-hmm. And there was some pushback initially from like some of the college administrators where they were like, Yaffa, you can't talk about this. Like your mental health, race is a different building. Gender is somewhere else. Orientation is not even on campus. It's just somewhere else. And I was like, that doesn't make sense. And because of how heavily involved I was, I think part of just survival, right, is we also learn how to use power, mm-hmm. right? How to navigate power, how to know when we have power. And I knew then that I had a lot of power. And so I just did it anyways. Like literally moved tens of thousands of dollars into mental health programming. And it was so beautiful to see the responses of people and specifically doing it in really intersectional ways before I even had language for that. And it was really through that, just really talking about things. So in a way, I kind of came out to the world before I really came out to myself because I didn't have space for it. And that just kind of continued that legacy. And a part of I think the benefit for me of just coming out so publicly in a way was that I've actually never had to come out with my family. I've never had to be like, parents, let's sit down. Let me tell you about things and give you an opportunity to be really awful if you want to, right? Or be really great, but we'll see. And I think that also just gave my family a little bit more time to adjust if they did need any of that. Yeah, so it was kind of actually a really easy transition to come out as queer and trans in a lot of ways, which is not what you would expect. But I think, again, at the same time, I was talking about things that really terrified, like my parents. Like I was talking about my experiences with like suicidality. And I think for them to hear all of that all at the same time just really brought things to perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so like now we're at a place where like I talk to my mom every couple of days. I talk to my dad, like it's not like we're in bad terms. It's just my dad doesn't like talking on the phone. And so we don't talk as often. And so my parents have been wonderful where they're really in a standpoint where they're like, y'all are our children. Like there's nothing that you could do that's going to make us not love you or not want you in our lives, period. Like we don't care about anything else anyone says. Nothing else matters. And I will say, like my family would be considered really religious in a way. But the community I grew up in was really religious in the sense of like we would pray and fast and things like that. But it was always people first. It was always justice first. It was always that Islam is a religion of justice. And that's the priority. And so I grew up like in protests on the streets in Phoenix. Kind of went downhill a little bit with 9/11 when community members just started disappearing. That kind of ended a lot of the activism that was happening. But like I grew up with that, of that Islam is about how you are with people versus just how you are with Allah. And so like my parents, my mom, I think is almost done memorizing the entire Quran. My dad goes to the mosque 5 times a day, like literally will not miss a prayer outside of a mosque, and they're in Jordan. So there's a mosque everywhere. So he's kind of fine. I still pray 5 times a day, but we were taught that that doesn't matter if it's not showing up in how you treat people. And that's always really stuck with me. And so even seeing like my parents' reactions with this has just been like really proof of like, they're really living that, right? Versus just being like, oh, this is something that I'm not used to, that I don't understand. And so you must be awful. And I will say in terms of like the larger family legacy, my grandparents were some of the first people that I knew about all of this. I didn't really come out to them. They just like, it would just come up and things like that. And they were like, okay, cute. Like what's wrong? What's the problem? Like, why would there be a problem kind of thing? And like my grandfather would talk about like queer spaces in Yaffa back in the day. And that's kind of a history that we've erased, of that Palestine used to be incredibly queer and trans back in the day.
Yes.
I just learned this. My grandfather didn't tell me this, but someone else's dad told them this. There was an entire like queerish city in Palestine. It was like if you wanted like queer neighborhoods and everything, like you would move there, be really close to community. And so like we were San Francisco before San Francisco was San Francisco, right? Like, so in terms of like the coming out, the queerness and transness piece, again, feels so abnormal to me because I don't hear many experiences like mine. And I will say, especially with the displacement as well, Like, mm-hmm. I have had to restart again and again and again and again. And mm-hmm. I guess, like, one of the pros of that to an extent is also there are so few people who would have known me as a non-queer trans person. Mm. And then now I have to go and be like, hey, let's talk right. about this.
Right.
Like,
right.
like pronoun changes, things like that. Sometimes I do. I went through a name change and things like that. I'll talk to people. I'd never been straight to begin with, mm. right? And like, mm-hmm. like publicly, like even in college, people were always just really confused because, again, I didn't have language yet. But they were like, is this a queer person? Is this a straight person? We don't know. Mm. And would have like debates about it and stuff. And I was just like, y'all are weird. Like, I'm going to go to work because I have 4 jobs. But like, y'all can continue debating this because I have bigger things to deal with right now.
So when was it that you connected with queer Muslim community?
So, okay. I actually connected with queer Muslim community as like a part of that community, actually just over the last few years.
Same.
Yeah. I feel like that's the case for so many of us. And so when masjid programming became virtual for COVID, I was finally in a place where I could actually like access some of the programs. I had heard about masjid a few years prior. I heard about masjid, I want to say it was in like 2016. And this was as I was working as an engineer and then also working as a peer support specialist and doing other mental health work within the broader Muslim community in Worcester. Severely dislike Worcester, but okay.
Worcester.
Oh my God. So I was doing all this work and even throughout college, I became a public speaker for like mental health, sexual assault prevention, things like that, and slowly just expanded. And so one of the universities that I had spoken at had invited me to come to this performance called Coming Out Muslim that Wazina and Taina were running, and who are two incredible individuals, but it was this two-person show about the experience of coming out as a Muslim for the two of them. And I was invited to this like lunch thing with like some of the organizers. And that was where I met one of the steering committee members from Masjid who told me about the retreat. And I didn't realize at the time that Taina was also part of the steering committee and that I've actually been working with Taina these past 2 years. And that memory, like those things did not connect for me until like a couple months ago. And I was like, wait, you're that person. But anyways, in that event, there was the dean who had invited me at the time was like, oh, I really want you to meet this unaccompanied trans minor from Syria. Mm. And I was like, yes, I would love to meet them. And they were the 16-year-old who was there with their social worker, who was this white woman. And this white woman refused to let this person talk to anybody there, to any of the queer Muslims, and would just glare at us, right? And so witnessing that, it was such a wake-up call for me at the time of like, no one else is going to do this for us. And so I shifted my entire peer support work to just working with unaccompanied trans minors from places like Syria.
Oh, wow.
And just various, specifically Muslim spaces. So from like, worked with people from like Sudan, Muslims from Ethiopia, just from wherever, and people just randomly find me. And so I would specifically do a lot of that support work. And I did that for a few years, again, until I had my own like queer trans Muslim community at Masjid. And then now I'm more involved with leadership within Masjid. But yeah, it's really been such a small amount of time before Masjid, other than the people I was working with. There was one person that I knew that was a trans Muslim, who was a trans Muslim convert living in the same state, like just knew the one. And I feel like that's the case for so many of us, where at most, like we might know one or have heard of someone, but to actually have people in our day-to-day lives. And I will say even like out here on like Occupied Ohlone Land, which has an immense amount of queer and trans people and even queer trans Muslims or queer and trans Swana folks and South Asians and just different people who really understand these things, it still took time to really like actually meet someone and another person. And so I yearn for the day when we could all be living like closer together or like in spaces where there's just where every day we're actually physically seeing one another. We don't even have to be friends. We don't have to be like fully in community, but I think it makes such a huge difference when you're just witnessing other people around you moving in their own ways. I think that by itself is such a powerful thing. And the opposite of that is also so powerful in the opposite way. I know, like, when I lived in Northern Ireland, for example, and I love Ireland. Ireland is such a beautiful country. Ireland has some problems to work through in terms of, well, some of their own problems, but also problems in terms of how they show up solidarity-wise, because one of the things that I always had a problem with in Ireland is I would see all of these Palestinian flags and also knew that I could get deported within the next few months, and there was nothing in between. The thing with Northern Ireland in particular is that it's still incredibly white. It's incredibly straight. It's incredibly cis. And so I literally would not see another person of color for months at a time. I lived there for 2 years and I did not know another trans person. So not even a trans Muslim person, but just a trans person, period.
Like, that doesn't surprise me. When were you there? Like, what years?
2020 to 2022.
Wow. Okay.
So I moved back last year. Yeah.
So I have a curiosity question.
Yeah.
How was it for you getting out of Syria?
So I was right by the border. Okay. And so before things really escalated. So as things started, so specifically they started in like Homs, and then they really moved towards the south, and a lot of violence was starting to happen in the south. And I think part of the reason that they did that was to get everyone to move away from the south. But in the beginning, those first few months, the border with Jordan was still open. So you were still able to move.
Yeah.
And this was even before like the UN came in and classified everyone as refugees and all of that kind of stuff. So I was part of like that wave. But again, because I was living in like both sort of, and I talk about this quite often, and still most people don't realize this of, so I was homeless at the time when I left home. And so Jordan doesn't really have an unhoused population, right? It's not like a lot of, it's not like out here, for example. And so it was really interesting being a part of that, and then also being able to like organize some mutual aid efforts and things like that, because I was so familiar with both. And that was actually when like I started doing like more mutual aid work, and it was a lot, but also it was so beautiful to just watch people coming together and people like really opening their homes, right? And like really showing up mutual aid wise. And unfortunately, though, that changed so fast when the UN, when the EU, when all of the international agencies brought in aid, because what they did, they didn't actually bring in aid. They just moved aid. And so what they did is they were like, okay, Palestinians, you've been in this refugee camp for like 70 years. How about we move all of the funding that we were giving you to Syrians now? It created so much animosity between communities because they would literally go to them and be like, yeah, like, you know, this isn't really our decision. We don't want to do this. It's the Syrians. They're really requesting this. And they're saying they wouldn't feel safe with you there. And so we have to just do it that way. And then doing it within the Syrian community, where they would just overnight change the aid. And one day they would be like, oh, like we're moving all of the funding to torture victims from sexual assault survivors. That's the greater need. And so people would lose their jobs overnight. They lost support systems. It just, I mean, now things have kind of settled down where a lot of that animosity has kind of gone away. But for a few years, like the different people who live in Jordan, which is like 50% Palestinian, 50% Jordanian. And then, you know, with the Syrians coming in, it became like 10, 20% Syrian. They really hated each other, right? Because of how all of these different agencies were pitting them against each other. And it's kind of like what happened with Ukraine, right? Of of being like, oh, we're going to give you all the aid and nobody else, right? It just creates so much tension and animosity between different groups.
Right.
Personally, I think they purposefully do that to really disrupt everything that we're doing. But prior to that, it was so beautiful how people came together. Like literally people opened up their homes, like anyone who had like a spare bedroom, an empty house. Like it was like people had a place to go immediately, even if they knew no one. And then over time, that changed drastically. And to be fair, I think it was like 2 million people ended up coming in from Syria over those few years. And so, you know, it did become much larger than what it was initially. So initially it was more of the people in the south who were kind of coming in, which was a much more manageable number.
Wow. And then from there to the States, huh?
Yeah, I had just enough money to apply to one college. It was basically all the money I had for food. And so I had no food for like 3 months afterwards. But somehow, magically, they accepted me to an engineering school because I barely passed like high school. But yeah, they had a program where basically you could submit something that was other than your standardized testing, because I never took the SATs because I couldn't afford them. So you would submit your like high school grades, but you could also submit an additional project. And so I just sent them a 100,000 word novel because I've been writing since I was 13. And I'm 100% certain they did not read it, but they were just like, okay, whatever. It's 100,000 words. Let this person in. It doesn't matter.
This person can do a project.
Right. Like, because I definitely lowered class GPA. It's one of those schools where it's like the incoming class's GPA is like 4.5 out of 4. Right. And then here I am with like a 2.7 or 2.8. I don't even remember, but like definitely a lot lower.
Next time, we'll talk more about Yaffa's advocacy work, as well as her poetry collection, Blood Orange, which is available for pre-order and will be released on November 17th. All profits will go to queer and trans Palestinians on the ground and queer and trans Palestinian work elsewhere. And as I understand, if you pre-order the hard copy, you can access the ebook now. Links are in the show notes. If this has been useful to you, please pass it along. And please keep showing up, keep raising your voice, and keep putting the pressure on. We have an episode in the works on resourcing that will come out soon. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.